This podcast is brought to you by Knowledge at Wharton. For more information, please visit knowledge.wharton.upenn.edu.
On Friday, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe will meet with President Donald Trump for the second time in 4 months. The pair met at Trump Tower in November, but now that Trump is making policy, the conversations will become more thoughtful on a variety of subjects. They are set to meet in Washington and then go to Florida to the Mar-a-Lago resort for the weekend. To discuss the meeting, we're joined on the phone by Richard Dasher, director of the East Asian Technology Center at Stanford University, and also by William Grimes, professor of international relations and political studies at Boston University. Richard, William, great to have you both on the show with us.
Good morning. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you. Great to have you both. William, in your mind, what are probably the key things that we should be focusing on as Abe comes to the United States?
So Japan has a major geopolitical problem. They have long depended on the United States for security and for a lot of their protection of economic interests. And China is, of course, rising right next to them. For Japan, the idea of being abandoned by the United States, which the Trump candidacy certainly raised as a possibility, is a very distressing thing from both the security point of view and the economic point of view. So for Prime Minister Abe, the most important things will be to continue to secure American commitment to Japan's security, to try to head off any aggressive actions on trade or currency issues, and to keep TPP, if not alive, at least not completely dead.
Richard?
I think that the security will probably be the first and biggest item of discussion. And I also think that trade will be pretty much exactly as William says. You know, Japan really is the kind of number two or number three country in terms of the U.S. trade imbalance. But the share of Japan's trade imbalance of the U.S. trade imbalance with Japan, the share that Japan holds has gone down from over 30% to 9% in the last year or two. So I'm sure that Prime Minister Abe will have lots of statistics to tell President Trump.
Bill, there was a report a couple of days ago that talked about this massive idea of investment that Japan is going to make, or at least offer, to the United States. And as I said, that was a couple of days ago. We haven't heard a lot about it since. I don't know if you had seen that reporting, and also, what did you make of it?
I did see the reporting. I think that in all of these cases, when massive sounding packages are created that sound almost unbelievable, that they are kind of unbelievable. So what is most likely being done here is they're taking an estimate of all the external investment that these companies were thinking of doing in the United States, of all Japanese companies, and they're pretending that it's all coming from Japan. So we saw a month or so ago that the head of SoftBank, Mr. Son, came to met with Donald Trump and said, we're going to be, you know, creating all these jobs, and we're going to be putting in all this money, and we're going to be creating great opportunities. So that may or may not be exactly right, and I think probably they're doing a lot of double counting because they own a big chunk of Sprint.
Yeah.
But the Japanese are basically going to be adding up all of the Japanese company pledges or expectations, and then presenting that. That's the biggest part of this. The other part is that demand for investment in Japan is quite low now, and Japanese companies are quite cash rich, and so Japanese companies should be investing somewhere. It makes a lot of sense that a lot of that will go to the United States, because the United States is one of Japan's largest FDI investment destinations in any event. So I think that it's probably significantly puffed up, but but if we look back in retrospect, we'll say, okay, so it wasn't completely just made up out of whole cloth.
But it is interesting, Bill, that one of the pieces that they talked about in some of this reporting involved high-speed rail, and not just in the Northeast Corridor, but down in Texas in some spots, and also in California, which high-speed rail is something that has been talked about for such a long period of time here in the United States, but it has never been able to kind of really get off the ground. it obviously has been a success in Japan.
Yes. So, and Japan is very interested in exporting its own versions of high-speed rail around the world. There have been a couple of fairly painful losses of high-speed rail contracts to Chinese companies because Chinese is cheaper. And so I think that the Japanese systems are among the best in the world. They're the ones that sort of work economically when you put them in the right place. And this has been on the wish list of Japanese companies that are involved in this and also the Japanese government going back into the late 1980s. The challenge, of course, is going to be regulatory. How do you get approval for those rail systems?
Right.
And second, who's going to pay for it? And there is a thirst for infrastructure investment if you can make money on it. But those are infrastructure investment as a means of creating large-scale investment in jobs, especially if you're thinking about high-speed rail is an aspirational goal.
Richard, one of the areas that I saw discussed that I guess Mr. Abe this week or in the last few days had met with the leaders of Toyota as well. And it was made pretty well known a few weeks back that Toyota was upping its investment in Indiana, Vice President Pence's home state. So I guess automakers would be a component one way or another, whether there's this massive infrastructure deal from Japan or not.
Well, the Japanese automakers are probably already one of the biggest sources of jobs at Japanese majority-owned companies in the United States. You know, there's over 41,000 jobs in Indiana that come from Japanese majority-owned companies. And that's not just the automakers themselves. These are the people that supply them and so forth. So, yes, that will be a big part of increasing Japanese foreign direct investment into the United States has to be one of the big strategies for helping to solve the trade imbalance. The infrastructure development is interesting because, of course, each state or each region has its own bidding process, and the U.S. government cannot guarantee the Japanese that they'll win. I do think that there will be infrastructure spending that opens up. And the Japanese systems have had a couple of high-speed rail systems have had a couple of recent successes. A big one was just in India, which announced it was going to use Japanese high-speed rail technology in developing its own high-speed rail system. And that's a big system.
844-WHARTON is the number if you'd like to give us a call and join in. 844-942-7866. We're joined on the phone by Bill Grimes of Boston University, Richard Dasher of Stanford University. Again, 844-942-7866. Or if you can't get your phone, you can send us a comment via Twitter, either at BizRadio111 or my Twitter account, which is at DanLoney21. Richard, you mentioned a little bit earlier about the want of companies to look for other places to make investment in the United States. What is the status of the Japanese economy going forward now, if you look in at least in the short term, in the next couple of years?
Well, if you look at Abe's own policies to encourage economic growth, they've discovered that innovation is a major key to growing beyond sort of the old big mass manufacturing stage. And I think that there will probably be at least some discussion of encouraging more partnerships between rapidly growing American tech startups and large Japanese companies. Japan is quite behind in using data analysis for, say, for instance, retailers or even in the financial industry. And so I would look at that as a kind of new area for possible cooperation.
Bill?
I completely agree. It reminds me to some extent of the late 1980s, early 1990s, when a number of the Japanese tech companies started setting up research institutes in places like Silicon Valley and around Princeton and in the Boston area, and partly to adapt technology from the universities, but also as sort of a lookout post for acquiring tech companies and the like. So I think that we're going to see a great deal of attention to that, both on the manufacturing side, but also the services end.
You mentioned, Bill, a little bit ago about TPP, and obviously that made quite a bit of news when President Trump took office. A lot of people have also wondered whether or not we would see discussion on a level of just a straight bilateral deal. Is it kind of a wait and see as to which path the two sides decide to go?
I think that the TPP story is a kind of a complicated one, because no matter what, who had gotten elected in this particular election, it wasn't going to happen right away. The hope was that you would have a president who came in who would be friendly enough that they'd do some fixes or changes, and then in a couple of years, depending on where congressional winds are blowing, that you might get the thing passed. So I think that the Japanese hope is that, having not managed to pull it off during the Obama years, they're just sort of trying to wait it out, and they were rather dismayed when President Trump signed the executive order withdrawing the United States from TPP. But that's not a particularly meaningful thing. It can always be it can probably be reinstated even if the deadline's going to be running out about, what is it, a year and a half from now.
Right.
The other piece is the idea of a bilateral free trade agreement, which is something people have been batting around for 30 years or more.
Right.
And I'm very skeptical of this. The whole benefit for the U.S. of TPP, or one of the big benefits, was the opportunity to get a U.S.-Japan free trade agreement inside of a multilateral pact.
Mm-hmm.
And the same was true for Japan as well. But the when you take off the sugar coating of TPP, and a rule-bound system and all of these other things, then all of these really deep fissures come to the fore about the way that people feel about Japanese automobile. They'll insist on putting in currency manipulation. I think it actually is much harder to pull off a bilateral FTA. And frankly, I can't imagine why any country would want to be the first to negotiate a free trade agreement with the Trump administration. Arguably, UK might, but these are going to be, you're restarting a long involved negotiation, and you know that you're dealing with somebody who's going to leave even less on the table than U.S. trade negotiators already do, and is
right.
likely not to honor the agreement in the longer run.
We are joined on the phone by Bill Grimes, who is a professor of international relations and political studies at Boston University, and also by Richard Dasher, who is a director of the East Asian Technology Center at Stanford University. Your comments again are welcome at 844-WHARTON, 844-942-7866. The other piece, Richard, which is, I guess, interesting, is also the fact that I would think energy and energy production and new ways to go about it would be part of the conversation as well.
Yes, that will be. Kind of back to what Bill just said, I think that probably Prime Minister Abe is going to try to keep from losing the agreements that we already have. I went back and looked through, and there are a lot of bilateral agreements in specific sectors between Japan and the U.S., one of which is energy. There is a U.S.-Japan bilateral commission on energy. There's a special bilateral agreement on space and on cyber policy and on climate change and on global health, so that there has been a lot of kind of agreements to cooperate. Now, most of these are not trade agreements in the sense of saying we're going to have, you know, this target or this quota for goods from a particular country, but they are areas in which the U.S. and Japan are cooperating very tightly,
right?
Especially after the Fukushima nuclear reactor disaster, the big earthquake up in northern Japan. There's been a lot more attention to bringing in U.S. experts and U.S. High technology to working on the problem.
Right.
Abe himself is relatively positive about nuclear power. And so he will probably enlist the United States in kind of supporting his own agenda in regard to allowing Japan to restart a lot of its nuclear reactors.
Bill, how do you see that energy discussion possibly going?
I think the point about having all of these various types of cooperative agreements is something that the Japanese want to continue to focus on, although I suspect it won't be the major part of this. But on energy, that's actually another piece of where Japan and investment might be an interesting story. So Japan is not going to be opening up a lot of new nuclear plants, and
right,
probably not even opening up a lot of old ones. But it is very interested in Japan, but it's very interested in exporting its technology. The Toshiba, which took over Westinghouse a little while ago, is the largest of the one of the largest of the nuclear power plant designers and fabricators and operators in the world, and they would be very interested in a Trump policy that was more welcoming to nuclear power, and that's a place where you also might see some infrastructure investment kicking in if the cost can be set up.
I think that's really important, especially Toshiba is bleeding red ink because of this Westinghouse purchase. And just yesterday they announced that all of their directors and above were going to take 60% pay cuts. And they're implementing other kinds of austerity measures, spinning off part of their semiconductor division, their semiconductor company, and selling it in order to keep the company going. So Toshiba is pretty desperate in order to have something solve their problem with, investing in nuclear power.
844-942-7866 is the number. If you have time to join in, your comments welcome. We're talking about Prime Minister Shinzo Abe coming to the United States. He'll be here on Friday to meet with President Trump in Washington, D.C., and then they will go down to Florida to discuss other matters over the weekend. One area, Bill, which we haven't touched on, but I saw it written about in the papers a couple of times this week, was North Korea. And the concerns in that part of the world about North Korea right now, and obviously part of it is the direct relationship with South Korea, but obviously it there are links to other pieces in that part of the world as well.
Japanese are terribly concerned about North Korea in reality and also in sort of show. So for going back quite a ways, North Korea has been a convenient way of justifying enhanced defense expenditures that help Japan against the rise of China, but that the Japanese public also takes it extremely seriously. The problem of North Korea is, of course, that we have very little traction, so it's a purely deterrent story. The Japanese, more generally, are quite concerned about the possibility of abandonment by the United States.
Right.
That's one of the classic problems of an alliance, and it's a particular problem for an alliance in which the new president has vowed to make radical changes in alliances. The Secretary of Defense, General Mattis, just took a tour through Japan and I believe South Korea as well, but in Japan, he was very reassuring, and so the big concern of Japan is that the Trump administration will be needlessly provocative and then not back up the allies. That will be, I think, really an extraordinarily important part of what Abe is trying to get when he's visiting with Trump. And he'll be willing to offer, enhanced roles and missions for Japan. Probably it's not in the cards to do a really big increase in Japanese defense budget, but there will be a really strong effort to get strong statements of solidarity, to have Trump verify what General Mattis said about support of Japan, defense of the Senkaku Islands, and host nation support, on all of which he was very positive. And I think that that Abe is really making an effort to bring that in. There's a particular headache in the U.S.-Japan alliance is a particular military base in Futenma City in Okinawa. And there's been an almost 20-year now impasse and moving through the plans on moving this thing. And just last week, we saw cement being brought into Oda Bay, which is where this thing, the new one's supposed to be built. So I think Abe is bringing that one as a sort of a promise to the administration that to really get them to commit to continuing the relationship as it is.
Richard?
And he'll have to remind President Trump that Japan is already paying quite a bit of the costs for the U.S. bases in Japan. That was an area that President Trump has mentioned a number of times during the campaign and since, that, you know, really the allies should be paying more. Well, the way that it's supposed to work is that Japan pays the costs of having the bases, including all of the local Japanese employees who work on the bases, and the U.S. is responsible for the actual military costs and the military operation cost. So Japan is probably already paying around $4 billion a year to have 85 U.S. bases in Japan. This is connected to Abe taking a more, actually kind of following what the U.S. wanted a couple of years ago, by agreeing for Japan to be more active overseas in collective security. Japan's constitution does not, you know, renounces war forever and says that Japan will not keep a standing army.
Right.
But they do have a large self-defense force, and they're spending quite a bit of money on defense and buying a lot of technology from the U.S. And since 2014, Japan can now attack or counterattack if someone attacks an ally as part of collective security. That's very controversial in Japan, and
right.
So Abe is probably going to want support from America for his position on that. I think that he's going to try to get a more clear statement from the U.S. about the Senkaku Islands in the East China Sea, because
yeah.
U.S. came out very strongly against China in regard to the South China Sea just a month or two ago. So there are things that he wants to get, and certainly the defense relationship is going to be a big part of it.
So it sounds like, in your mind, this meeting is much more important to Abe than it is to President Trump. Am I right on that, Richard?
I think that you're getting posturing for the country, and President Trump is still in the point of trying to show that he's delivering on his promises.
Right.
And I think that Abe is really trying to, he's much further into his administration, and so he really needs to deliver some things. What I do think is that the two of them are probably going to try to recreate some sort of a Ron-Yasu relationship, like Ronald Reagan had with Yasuhiro Nakasone back in the early 1980s. This idea of going down to Florida and playing golf together is definitely aimed at looking like there's a close personal relationship between the two.
Bill?
I agree. There's a couple points I think that are quite important. First off is anytime the U.S. and Japan have a major negotiation, Japan always... it's always more important to Japan than to the United States. And, of course, in this case, it's the U.S. that's throwing things into question. So I think that is certainly the way that that the Japanese see it, too. I'm not sure that that the Trump administration fully understands how important Japan is to the United States, outside of the military folks, who I think have a very keen understanding. Particularly, there are certain functions that even the U.S. 7th Fleet, this amazing war machine, can't do without Japan at the moment. They
right.
would actually have to do a lot of ramping up. So there's quid pro quo, but there's certainly a lot more need on the Japanese side. And I think that Richard's point about the personal relationship is that's something that Japanese leaders, for whatever reason, care deeply about, at least the optics. In some cases, there's actually, I think, a proper personal relationship, but they really do care about this idea of a personal relationship between the leaders of the countries as sort of undergirding the larger national commitment. So there will be for the Japanese, it will be very important to have those optics of the Gulf and other things.
Well, I mean, let's be honest about this. How many businessmen here in the United States say that their best deals get done on the golf course, right? So, I mean, who knows what could get accomplished in 18 holes?
Absolutely. And usually you know, as a political scientist, I tend to minimize the particular role of personal relations among leaders.
Yeah.
And there are certainly personal relations among leaders that are very bad, and they cooperate well. But with Trump, the personal seems to be above all else in a lot of ways. And so I would certainly, if I were advising the Japanese prime minister, which I'm not, I would say go in there and make friends and get a personal level of rapport and trust that because it's gonna be immensely important when you come down to decisions.
Great to have you both on the show. Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Richard. All the best to you both.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bill Grimes from Boston University, Richard Dasher from Stanford University.
For more business news and analysis from Knowledge at Wharton, please visit knowledge.wharton.upenn.edu.